Business, Arts, Workforce, Climate, and Aviation Services Committee of Denver City Council. This session of the Business, Arts, Workforce, Climate, and Aviation Services Committee begins now.
All right, good afternoon. My name is Chantel M. Lewis, and I represent District 8, and I'm also the chair of the Business, Arts, Workforce, and Aviation Services Committee, or BIS, well, until today. We have three action items today, beginning with two from excise and licensing, and then an update on Waste No More. Before we get into those, I will start with a round of introductions, beginning with you, Councilman Flynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver's District 2.
Roland Vidres, Lucky District 7.
Amanda Sandoval, Northwest Denver District 1.
All right. With that, you can introduce yourselves and jump into your presentation.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, Molly Duplashane, Executive Director of Excise and Licenses.
And I'm Erica Rogers, I'm the Policy Director of Excise and Licenses.
All right, well, we're excited to be here today. We have a proposal and an idea that we're excited to present to you. It's about an exciting modernization to Denver government that we are proposing to change the name of the Department of Excise and Licenses to the Department of Licensing and Consumer Protection. We will go over a little bit of background as to why we are bringing this proposal to you, some history of the department, and some next steps. But before I fully jump into the presentation, I do just want to recognize and thank Councilwoman Gilmore for supporting us and co-sponsoring this bill. We've had a great partnership with her. Her leadership around the residential rental license was significant. And at the heart of that license and ordinance was really consumer protection or tenant protection in this case. And so just wanted to thank you for that. All right, so what does excise and licenses do? Our mission is to protect the public through regulation of businesses. And we achieve that through issuing licenses to businesses and individuals. We issue both business and occupational licenses. We educate our licensees on the importance of compliance with licensing regulations, and then we can correct non-compliance to hold licensees accountable and create confidence in regulated businesses. So right now we offer and we have about over 100 different types of businesses and occupational licenses, and we issue over 50,000 active licenses a year. So we achieve that mission through the work of those businesses licenses. A little bit about what we don't do, which is impose or collect any type of taxes or even excise taxes. That all happens within the Department of Finance. And then contrary to when people call us an exercise in licenses, we also don't regulate or oversee exercise. But it is a common mistake that we hear sometimes, and I think it just speaks to the fact that the word excise is an outdated term and not one that really resonates with the general public, and people will make people understand what it is that we do. So why do we want to change our name? We really think this is a pretty simple but impactful change, really for the general public to understand the services that we provide and where they can access those services. You know, the current name is confusing and misleading. It references functions that the department does not oversee, like excise taxes. But I think just as important as removing the word excise from the department are the words that we want to add to the department, which is consumer protection. So we were really intentional and thoughtful about the words licensing and consumer protection, and feel like those two words are very, they balance and reflect our two core functions. You know, through licensing, we use the licenses tools to create and foster accountability for safety and compliance. And then that allows us to ensure consumers are protected, that those businesses are meeting health and safety standards, that we can support consumers in making confident choices and really helping businesses thrive in that way. And I think it just all comes down to, we think the new name will more accurately reflect our services and will give the public a general understanding of what we do. And Erica will go into some history, but we did just want to highlight this great quote from a former director of excise and licenses from 1990. where she said the main purpose of licensing is not to generate money, but to protect public health, safety, and well-being of the people of Denver. And I think when people hear excise and licenses, it sounds very governmenty, bureaucratic, and really that's not why we're here, not to just issue licenses for the purpose of being government, but really because we do want to protect consumers and we want to make sure that our citizens can go out and utilize the businesses within their community or operate as neighbors within their community and feel that they are protected and safe.
So one question, folks who are following along at home or folks here may be wondering, why is excise in our name to begin with? And so to kind of go through that, I'm going to do a little bit of a history lesson on how we got there, starting back in 1904. So Denverites first approved our Home Rule Charter on March 29th, 1904. And at that point, licensing was handled by a 3-member fire and police board. So that fire and police board had a fire commissioner, a police commissioner, right, that safety piece, as well as an excise commissioner that was in charge of tax collection and licensing. So from the very beginning of that initial charter, we were talking about excise taxes and licensing together. From 1912 to 1916, Denver did a little experiment in commission form of government. And so during that time, there was an excise department, also 3 members. One of those included the Commissioner of Finance, who was tasked with both of those responsibilities, collection of tax and licensing. In 1916, we had the Speer Amendment, which ended that era of commission-style government. It ushered in the form of Denver government we know today, with a council and a mayor and an administration. And one of the mayor's 4 original cabinet members oversaw the Department of Safety and Excise. So all through this point, right, the issues of safety and the issues of excise tax and licensing were all handled by one body, one entity, and it was a lot of work. So come 1971, after a couple of attempts, the Denver voters decided that, yeah, that is too much work for any one department. And so they voted to split the Department of Safety and Excise into 2 departments that we have today. So they kept all of the safety responsibility for fire and police and things like that in our Department of Safety and created a new Department of Excise and Licenses, more accurately reflecting at the time what that agency had done since 1904. However, since 1972, as the city has grown and modernized, as Molly mentioned, our department no longer handles excise taxes or any taxes of any kind. Those are our friends over in DOF. And so currently, and what the bulk of what we've been doing in the modern times has been licensing for the purpose of that consumer protection piece. Another thing that you might be wondering is, of those 100 license types, where are some examples of that consumer protection, right? Help me understand that work that you already do and have been doing. And so, like Molly mentioned, we have over 100 license types. I won't list them all, but some of our most well-known are liquor and marijuana, but we also provide consumer protection in other aspects, right? Patrons of retail food establishments, diners at any of our Denver restaurants, tenants of our residential rental properties, neighbors of short-term rentals or neighbors of bars that may play music, as well as patrons of businesses that employ security guards to provide protection. Parking lots is another one, and I'll mention this throughout, but parking lots is an area where we are constantly getting feedback from consumers about information that's helpful about our licensed community. And so we can use that information in many ways. We can update resources for the licensees so that they're able to be in compliance with information. We're also able to, for example, adopt rules that help increase safety by increasing the lighting requirements for certain parking lots. Or, right, if we think an ordinance needs changed and we think there need to be additional protections, we can always go that route as well. So next I'll go over some proposed language changes that you'll see. And yes, this is 2 action items. I'll talk about that in just a second. There are 2 bills here, but the key changes are the same across those 2 bills. So first, to be consistent with other charter departments and cabinets, agency leaders, we will have using the term manager instead of executive director. So you'll see some of those amendments in various sections referring to the name change of the leader of our agency. We'll also be removing the references to excise taxes. Those references will still remain, again, in the Department of Finance areas, but they'll be removed from our charter section. And then one of the other big changes is that we will be ensuring that the department is in the mayor's cabinet. In all of our research, we can't find any particular reason. Molly's actually the only executive director that is in a charter agency who's not currently listed in the cabinet, and we think this was perhaps just a Scrivener's error when that amendment passed in 1971, as that manager of safety and excise had always been in the cabinet. Finally, right, the overarching change you'll see is updating and simplifying language wherever possible, just making sure that a few things are easier to read, more clear, but at any rate, not changing any authorities that we currently have, not adding any additional authority, really just modernizing the language across the charter and the code. And so for those following along at home, you'll see two bills. So I do just want to take a second to walk through those. I think members of council are really familiar with the process, but a charter change does require a ballot initiative to go to the vote of the people. And so the first bill is going to be that bill that would place the question on the ballot, right? And so I've put the titles of both bills here. And so that charter change has to be approved by the voters. So that's the first bill. The second bill is what we're calling a companion bill. That's 1003. And so we run them together so that folks at home can see all of the changes all at once, even though that shorter change to the charter is what they're voting on, and the updates to the Denver Revised Municipal Code are under the purview of council. Having all of the changes at once kind of shows the work that we're saying, right? We're not adding anything additional. We're not hiding anything. You can see all the places that we've updated, both the name of the head of our agency as well as the agency itself. So that second bill's about 130-ish pages, and it's really mostly a find and replace, but a really thorough work by, again, our council attorney staff to help us get there. So again, both bills are being considered as action items today so that you can see the whole package of changes. However, one key difference is that if council approves the charter bill to move forward, the final action that would come of that is that the question is on the November ballot. Now, the second companion bill, if council approves that, it would not become effective until and unless the voters approve the ballot question in November. So that just ensures that those changes would be automatic and nothing else would be added or changed.
Great, so I think the next question is just what this would look like if council and the voters approve these bills. And really, it'll look a lot like it does today. And so our department will continue to do all of the work that we do, issuing licenses, providing resources to consumers, investigating complaints, educating the public, both the consumers and the licensees, enforcing license requirements, and then advocating for consumers. And what that looks like is really something we already do and will continue to do, which is to address any gaps in regulation. And we can do that through both policy or bringing legislation to this body. And so along those lines, something that we have already done is we've given our complaint portal a bit of a facelift and have kind of rebranded it as a consumer protection complaint intake portal. And we're really hoping that this will help facilitate these lines of communication with the public to know that this is a place that they can bring their concerns. Now, not everything that a consumer, every issue they experience is something that we will be able to address, but we are planning with this consumer protection intake portal that we'll set up a really robust referral process. We work closely with our other regulatory partners, either at the state or other city agencies or other organizations, and so we'll be able to refer their complaints to the appropriate location. And then also just provide support and resources if we can do that as well. And then where there are cases where we cannot address their concern, we'll still be able to provide a response and get them connected to services. And then we'll use this data and what we collect through this intake portal to make sure that if there are gaps in regulation, that we will continue to address those as we go forward, whether that's through education, additional policy changes, additional regulations, that type of thing. So finally, just to kind of cover next steps and where we are and what we've done so far, we launched this new intake portal a couple of months ago, so we're already starting to get some inquiries and requests and looking into those where we can. And then we have worked with the city attorney's office to draft the proposed charter change and the companion language that Erica mentioned. And then, so now we're here in July presenting this through the city council process. And assuming there's no objections or that this gets through committee, then I think the plan is to get this filed in time to be at first reading this coming Monday and at second reading the 28th, so that we can kind of have that time to make sure that we're getting onto the ballot. And then if it does, it will be on the ballot. The election is November 4th, and assuming it passes, we'll have all of the implementation work, changing the website, changing our stationery, changing our signage. We do not anticipate any additional costs. All of that work will be done in-house, and as we kind of run out of our supplies with the old name, we'll order them with the new name, and so we don't anticipate there to be any cost associated with the name change, which I think is a pretty important point right now. And then, as Erica mentioned too, then assuming it passes, the companion bill would then become effective too, and all the corresponding changes within the code would be made. So I think that's it. We appreciate your consideration of it. I know you all have a lot of hard choices to make, and we're hoping that this is a pretty straightforward one where we can recognize that the term excise and licenses is outdated and confusing, and we can do better for our citizens in having a more recognizable name. Thank you.
Thank you all so much. I'd like to recognize Councilwoman Romero Campbell. She is online. And then Councilwoman Gilmore, did you want to say anything before we jump into the queue?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really happy to support the name change. I think the clearer that we can be with the community around what an agency does, that's always a great first step. And we've outgrown those names, and so happy to support. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Councilman Flynn, you're first in queue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Molly, I think you addressed my question right at the end. It was going to be, has there been an estimate of the cost of this? And you said there's no cost, but there's probably not no cost. So what, I mean, you said you're going to change signage, things like that.
Yeah, so.
So how's that going to be?
So there,
it doesn't sound like it's going to be a mountain. It'll be
yeah, we're not requesting any additional budget or anything like that. There will be time invested, right? So internally, we have folks that update our website. They will have to take the time to update our website.
They do that already.
Yes, we are constantly making revisions and updates. So we'll go in and we'll catch all the places where it says excise and licenses. We'll work with the internal technology services marketing team to make sure that we have all of that. And so again, that's internal time and cost, not cost, but internal resources. Mm-hmm. Like I said, stationery and things like that, we won't order a whole bunch of new ones. We'll just use the current ones we have until we have to order new ones.
You actually have stationery?
We do, yes.
I mean, when I send letters by mail, I have a template in Word, and it's got the headers on it, and I print it out. So I don't actually have any.
We have envelopes and things like that that have our name already printed on them.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
So we do. It's minimal. Definitely now, some of those hard stuff is minimal now, but we do have some of that. And then we actually just recently moved back into the web building, and so we don't have a sign right now. So we're kind of holding off, and if we get a new name, then we'll get a new sign.
Oh, okay. Where were you before?
We moved places in the web building, and we were temporarily over at Republic Plaza for a little while.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. You were actually the only person in the queue, and I just have.
Oh, I had.
I am so. And I just said,
I got you. I didn't have you. I'm sorry. Councilmember Alvidrez, I'm so sorry.
No worries. Thank you. I appreciate this. Thank you for all your work. I think it's important that this our residents sometimes don't feel like we're doing things for them, and we are, and so how we tell that story is so important. So I think this is part of that. And also, it sounds like also more work, right? You're going to be doing things that maybe you weren't doing a couple years ago. Is that correct?
I think there's possibility of that, whether we have our current name or use this new name. So I think there, you know, we've added several licenses to our department over the last couple of years as new and emerging business practices have come about, whether that's the residential rental license or short-term rentals is a fairly newer license too. So as things emerge in the market, we try to address them through our business licensing. And, you know, I think it's possible that we could have more concerns brought to our attention that might require us or prompt us to change our regulations. But
being the complaints.
The complaints,
people,
yeah.
People couldn't do that before, correct?
They could. We've received complaints around parking lots for years, and so we think there is a gap in the regulations there. So Okay. Even as the Department of Excise and Licenses, addressing the gaps in regulation for parking lots is something we will probably want to do in the near future one way or the other. So that work is on our plate with this name or not. And I think it's just, it makes it more clear for the citizens.
Yeah, you would be amazed when we go out to the community and we talk to RNOs, and they'll always pull us aside after and say, hey, I have a concern, a question. Can you do this, or can you update this? It's not working. Mm-hmm. And I say, oh, have you submitted a complaint specifically if it's about a particular business that multiple community members are having an issue with? And they'll say, well, I don't know how to do that. And so that was, I think it's not that they've never been able to do that. I think people weren't aware of it, or, right, we didn't have the kind of consumer protection intake portal, yeah. Right? Just even the name of it, it was compliment or complaint form, right? And so, again, how we tell our story, how we market ourselves to the community, how we present ourselves and the services that we're able to offer, I think there will be, we'll be doing more of that work because people will be more aware that we can.
That's, I think that's important, and I'm excited for this. I also was wondering, with the complaint process, so the complaint process isn't new, it's just changing, is that correct? Okay. Is there going to be education, though, around this? Because I know you're just changing signs, but I would hope that there would be some kind of outreach, maybe going to more community events and talking to more people so they know that this is available to them. And I totally understand you, because everywhere I go every day, that's what happens to me. And so I'll be able to direct people maybe to one place, which will be very helpful.
Yes. Yeah, I think socializing the intake portal, especially if we have some, if we do have a new name and we can have some new branding and kind of get that message out. We do have a bulletin list that anyone can sign up for now. It's on our website. If you'd like to receive updates about the consumer protection work we're doing, that's one way you can stay up to date. The other thing I'll say is that our portal does have some information right at the very first stage of intake on common complaints, right? Because the term consumer protection is very broad, and so people may have different ideas about what we can help with. And so we're pretty upfront to say, here are some common things that aren't handled by us, they're handled by other agencies, for example, the Public Utilities Commission. Mm-hmm. However, we do encourage folks, if you're not sure, feel free to submit, because we're working on just every day increasing our capability to build that robust referral system. So if there's a complaint that we get, but it can be addressed by HRCP, or it can be addressed by the Attorney General's office. We've built those relationships where we can do that soft handoff. We can help connect people. And like Molly said, even if we can't solve their issue, we can tell them, hey, that's not us, but we can tell you who it is, right? And
yeah,
so if they've started,
very helpful.
Yeah, so if they've start with us, we are committed to that.
Great. And so I heard you talk about parking. Definitely agree that we need some more oversight there. And I'm curious, will contractors be a part of this? And I think one of the things that residents don't always know is they can go on and like see if the contractor exists, if they're actually licensed, so that if something goes bad, they actually have some recourse. So
Contractor license. So that is currently regulated by and issued by Community Planning and Development.
Okay.
But the similar kind of setup, right, where they can intake complaints and respond to concerns and address those through enforcement of that license. And so.
And then you would kind of pass that over to CPD then?
Yeah, if we got a concern or a complaint about a contractor, yes, we would work with CPD on that.
Great, awesome, thank you. That's all I had, thank you.
Great, sorry again.
I just have one quick question for you all regarding the removing the references to excise taxes from this section. I was just curious as to where that will be discussed in the charter if you're removing it from this section.
That might be an area where I should defer to the attorney.
I'm still working to the last minute.
Thanks for the question, Councilman Lewis. So taxes are still going to be addressed by Department of Finance. The current provision in the charter that says anything about excise taxes for excise and licenses probably shouldn't exist. It's not a provision that the department actually exercises. Excise taxes are just a form of taxes. Department of Finance does all the taxes in the charter as it's written right now.
Great, thanks. Super helpful. That's it. Any other questions for any? Flynn?
Well, I like that because it means we're going to excise the reference from the charter.
There you go. Well,
thank
you all so much for your presentation.
Old
really
journalists
appreciate
never
it.
Die.
We need a motion. Is this an action? Thank you. Council President Sandoval, Councilwoman Gilmore. Do you need a roll call vote? All right, great. Thank you all so much. Really appreciate it. All right, second presentation, Waste No More.
Is this your phone?
Rocky together. Can't get away from it.
Are we then on the slides ourselves?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes, come on, just come over here.
So while you all are getting set up, I just want to kind of set the table for this item, which has been heard by this committee multiple times. The last time it came to committee, we postponed it to allow for the negotiations between the members of the Waste No More Task Force and the mayor's office, as there was a gap between what the task force recommended and what was being proposed in terms of implementation. We've called both parties back to discuss those negotiations and where they ended up. And I would like to have the members of the task force give us a short presentation, no more than 15 minutes, please, to explain what the task force was looking for before allowing the mayor's office to speak about what was or wasn't agreed to. And then I would ask council members to hold off on your questions until the end of the mayor's office presentation in their words. And then you all can introduce yourselves and take it away. Task force members.
Fantastic. Introductions first?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So my name is Brian Loma. I am the Hazardous Materials and Waste Diversion Advocate for Green Latinos Colorado. I was one of a multitude of original proponents for the Waste No More ballot measure. And I would also note that I serve as a board member for Good Business Colorado and in the environmental justice seat for the state's advisory board for the EPR, Extended Producer Responsibility. But again, I represent myself here today as Green Latinos.
And I was not a member of the task force, but I am Jessica Herrera. I am in-house counsel for Green Latinos.
And we may have Ian Tafoya, Chris Chiari, and Noah Kaplan online.
Okay.
If they're able to get in on Zoom. Ian is obviously the primary proponent of the Waste No More ballot measure. Chris Chiari served in the business seat, and Compost Colorado had a representative as a Waste No More on the task force, and one of the representatives may be online as well.
Not, they haven't joined yet, but I'll let you know when they do.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So where we are. In 2022, 70.8% of Colorado of Denver voters indicated a desire for effective waste diversion. In 2023, the task force was convened with strong consensuses on implementation strategies. In 25, the city began presenting shifts to the task force recommendations based on lobbying both from departments and the Colorado Restaurant Association. And I will note, that those modifications also included legal requirements for implementation, not just lobbying. In June, we were here, and you advised us to come back and negotiate. We came to the table, did not feel that there was an effective negotiating process for many of the recommendations. I will note that on the C and D end, our task force member, Anna Perks, with Perks Deconstruction, did negotiate some changes that we feel are able to be working moving forward. Today, what we have is a red line version per the standards of the state legislative process, where you take a bill and you mark out what you want to change and the recommended changes to it, so it's easy to see. And Jessica will be covering the majority of those, with myself updating as needed. These updates under the plan fall under some basic areas. Removing sweeping permanent exemptions to the plan. Updating language pieces, like literally Spanish, Vietnamese requirements, as well as training and reporting requirements, including some entities that we realized were omitted, and expanding aspects of diversion requirements over time. Jessica?
So in addition to the negotiations that Ann Perks has been making with the mayor's office, we are proposing some of our own.
C&D.
Yeah, so the C&D provisions don't explicitly have a de minimis exemption, but they do have an exemption for the C&D of buildings 500 square feet or less, and for the modification of buildings with 2,500 square feet or less. So we are proposing a phased-in so that the language, you can see that we add to limit the current thresholds in years 2025 through 2035. And then we add a new subsection B that maintains that same structure but reduces those square footage thresholds. And our rationale behind that is that Denver Homes' average square footage is much less than 2,500 square feet. And then I will also mention that in the proposed ordinance, there is a provision that basically states that the executive director of the community and planning may adjust the exemptions, and we have left that provision intact. So in our addition of subsection B, would basically also be subject to those adjustments as well. And then one last caveat, the proposed ordinance also includes a table that illustrates subsection A thresholds, which the manager of the community and planning is authorized to adjust, provided that any such adjustment be adopted in the rules and regs. And we presume that the same process would be necessary and that a figure 1B would have to be added to illustrate these proposed lower thresholds. And then moving on, and then for the special events, this section exempts permitted events with 350 attendees from the recycling and organic material collection requirements. We are reducing this figure from 350 to 300 to align with the task force recommendations. And this section also exempts permitted events with 1,000 daily attendees from the organic material collection requirements, and we are changing that from the daily threshold to an aggregate amount based on the total duration of the permanent event.
Any questions so far?
We'll save questions
for the mayor's office. Fantastic.
Yeah. Perfect. Then moving on to the next slide. And so here we are amending the definition of what constitutes a food waste producer, and Brian can go more into detail about the policy decision about that. But food banks were explicitly omitted from the definition of food waste producers, so we're striking that and then adding it to the definition of what a food waste producer is, as well as adding other entities such as food caterers, ghost kitchens, and any facility that produces or receives food for on-site consumption.
So the idea behind adding these facilities very specifically is that in the state model for food rescue and donation, food ends up at the food bank, and then they're excluded from diverting that from the landfill. And so a lot of food could end up that's not necessarily consumable at the end of stage. And we want to make sure that that is receiving a the ability to eliminate the organic food waste creation. And then again, there's a lot of different types of facilities where there's a kitchen or service to a building where the food isn't prepped on site. And so we want to make sure that whether it's the back of the house for a food truck or any place where food is being served but may not have been included because it wasn't being prepared on site, that organic diversion is being included in that as well.
And then moving right along, here is the exemption for restaurants that were intended for smaller restaurants that the mayor's office included in the proposed ordinance. And to my understanding, this exemption was not part of the task force recommendations and was added entirely by the mayor's office. So this was one of our biggest points of contention. So as currently drafted, the exemption would allow retail food establishments with less than $2 million in revenue in the prior year and with less than 25 employees to be exempt. During our discussions with the mayor's office, it seems like the intention was to allow smaller restaurants some relief, but that intention was not necessarily to allow all restaurants, regardless of the thresholds. And the language in the proposed bill would essentially allow any new restaurant to be exempt because it's based on the calculated data from the previous year. So yeah, if a restaurant is new, it would automatically be exempt. So this is a much broader exemption than I think even the mayor's office intended. So our proposed red lines were in just good faith to hear the concerns that the mayor's office has. They want to provide some kind of balance and to phase in smaller restaurants. So our language is intended to, one, close that loophole that clarifies that only restaurants that have data are exempt from that previous year, and then to address that new restaurants may still be allowed for that exemption, but only if they themselves can prove that they also meet those thresholds. And then three, to provide some kind of like phase in so that the exemption ends in 2030 unless certain criteria are met. And this is where we thought we were bringing our good faith. So we are changing. Under our proposed changes, the requirements would apply to all businesses by April 1st, 2026, with the ability to file up to two-year exemptions back-to-back. And these exemptions would require a waste diversion plan to exist and that there be a proven financial hardship, or that the diversion volume is under 60 gallons a week, or that a service is unavailable either individually or through a co-op. And then I also wanted to mention that we are also changing the methodology in which the exemption is based upon. So Brian can go more into the rationale behind those changes, but I just wanted to briefly point out that in our discussions with the mayor's office, you know, it was our understanding that the exemption is for smaller restaurants. And so as part of requiring that only small restaurants be exempt, they added language that says that only restaurants with 25 employees or less can qualify, and that language to us wasn't clear. So we added some language that states that it has to be an aggregate employee amount account. So, and then also including some contractors as well in that.
So I'll just, yeah, add a couple of tidy pieces here, and then we're about done with our presentation. Never before has there been any that we could find in the United States a starting point for establishing a requirement and diversion based on a financial status of a business versus the volume of waste that it created. So what we looked at was all the organic haulers in the city consider 60 gallons to be a minimum justifiable amount for, or in that ballpark, for contracting their services as a food establishment. So if you're only making 20 gallons of food waste, it's not worth a pickup. The 60 gallon amount establishes roughly 0.2 metric tons of methane emissions per year. And so we set standards that deviated from a financial books to a transactions or volume of business. So if a restaurant isn't doing at least 50 transactions a day, it's probably creating a de minimis amount of waste as well. You know, again, looking at that calculation of 60 gallons. The other aspect that we did was in order to hear the concerns of the Colorado Restaurant Association and the mayor's restaurants, we put a four-year buffer, two-year exemption periods, where organizations could take the time to assess not only their books, but the availability of resources, while mandating that they create a diversion plan, something that the original request omitted.
All right.
Reporting.
Moving right along. So we did make some changes to the reporting provisions. Basically, for the first 10 years, we are requiring that reporting be made every 3 years. And then we're retaining the structure that the original proposed language had, where it was up to the discretion of the executive director to report every 3 to 5 years.
So just to keep us moving, some other general provisions that we updated for organic and certified compostables, so that we're actually defining in conjunction with state law the types of materials that could be accepted and should be considered. And we are highlighting for back of the house contamination to highlight that food trucks and other restaurants may not be able to do front of the house, whether they're off-site, but where the prep kitchens are, where that work is happening, the back of the house materials should be able to be capturable. We also introduce the concept that not only should there be a waste diversion plan, but that the training of the plan should move all the way through the system, from the property manager or the contractor of the waste services, all the way through to any person who might be utilizing that in the back of the house, something that the current legislation did not include. And that training would also then be the responsibility of a property manager who's renting to a tenant to make sure that they are taught how to use the diversion streams to help avoid contamination issues. On the next one, again, updating that language to ensure that the training is provided to food waste producers. And why did we want to do this? Well, we wanted to focus the language issues where we're updating from just Spanish to the secondary language that's being used on site, and using other program experiences since Waste No More was drafted in 2020 that have been learned over the last 5 or 6 years. So we were enhancing the language red lines that we put in. We've looked at enhancing reporting for the first 10 years so that it's not twice in the first 10 years, but we get those three reports as the mayor's office had conceded to ensure that we're reviewing the effectiveness and making adjustments as necessary. We've also intended to, you know, through our food waste producer red lines, to hear the concerns of small business. We want to be acknowledging that Denver needs to have thriving businesses who are supported in their best practices, but that the shift, while it may, you know, be painful for some, is a necessary shift for all. To highlight that necessary shift for all, we have passed around a secondary rulemaking that's happening and a report from the City and County of Denver. We're in the statewide rulemaking process for landfill methane emissions, and we have received a rebuttal from the city in the landfill methane emission efforts, because Denver is looking at putting in gas systems that require organic materials to be fed into a landfill to produce methane. And so we acknowledge that where the city may be looking at other methodologies of dealing with landfill methane, the fastest way to eliminate methane creation is to eliminate the materials from being put in the landfill in the first place. And these processes are designed to hit the 2050 goals that the governor has laid out for climate change. So diverting the material based on volume is the answer that we believe is the best solution. That's all we have.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate you all taking the time. I just wanted to say, before the mayor's office has the opportunity to chime in, that these are recommendations that are not currently in the proposal. These are the recommendations that are coming from the task force. And so that's not what council members nor this committee is considering, because we can't in committee. But these are recommendations that are coming directly from the task force. And the mayor's office will tell you what it looks like in current form. So, great. Okay.
Thank you, Councilwoman, and thank you all for the time. I'll just quickly introduce myself. Like Jonathan, Tim Hoffman, I'm in the mayor's office. I'm his director of policy.
I'm Jonathan Wachtel, deputy executive director of the Climate Action Sustainability and Resiliency Agency.
Yeah, and just to level set, in terms of going line by line through the proposed red lines from Green Latinos, we received both of the red line documents in the last 36 hours. I understand everyone's working really hard, and it's hectic for everybody. So we're not prepared to go line by line through those now. We absolutely will have responses, and you know, we accept this or we have an issue with this. Certainly before this gets to the floor, if it does in the next couple of weeks. But just to, I think, higher level set here. In terms of what Brian was laying out, he's exactly right that this has been a really long road where he and some other advocates starting in 2020, maybe even earlier, fought really hard to get this on the ballot. Over 70% of voters said that they wanted a sea change in how composting and recycling takes place. A group of task force members from across the city came together and came up with a list of recommendations. And then city agencies have spent the better part of the last year figuring out how to implement it, right? It is a massive undertaking to get something this transformative up and running. The sidewalk program, which you all are intimately familiar with, is also a very heavy lift, but that by and large includes one agency. It's DOTI, right? There are some other people who get involved, but it's by and large being run by DOTI. This has CASR, it has Community Planning and Development, it has DDPHE, it has Excise and Licensing, or whatever their new name may or may not be in the next month or so. It touches, I think, 8 or 9 separate agencies. So it's been a massive lift to get it to this point. As it relates to the outstanding disagreements that the mayor and the administration have with the Green Latinos organization and some of the task force members, it really was the three outstanding issues at the last committee hearing were around the construction and demolition diversion requirements, were around that exemption for small restaurants, and then it was around the exemption for events. The two that remain to be the sticking point, as Brian was alluding to, are that small restaurant exemption and the events exemption. And I know that there has been a lot of discussion about the Colorado Restaurant Association, other lobbying that's taken place. These exemptions, and specifically as it relates to the small restaurant exemption, are based on the mayor's belief that small restaurants, where it is possible, should get financial relief and help. And that's based on his conversations with small restaurant owners. That's based on the data that we're all aware of, that in the last year, 18 months, small restaurants really are struggling. And so any kind of suggestion that it's anything other than the mayor's genuine belief and desire to give relief to those smallest restaurants is just not founded. The proposal that we've put forth that has the money requirement, the $2 million in revenue, and then the employee requirement, we believe is the best way that we've come up with to target those smallest restaurants in the city. It would be about 16% of all the restaurants. I'm unaware, I don't know if you guys know kind of the percentage of restaurants that would fall when you start talking about transactions, but we're pretty confident based on the tax data that it's about 16% of all the restaurants. As it relates to the events that would be exempted, it is events 1,000 or fewer people, daily attendees. That would represent about 70% of all events, which is a very large number, but the vast majority of people in the city go to events that are over 1,000. 1,000 daily attendees, which said another way means about 92 or 93% of people in the city would be going to events that have composting and recycling requirements. That recommendation is also based on the mayor's concern about community-based and smaller events, and then we also heard a lot of feedback from you all as council members. I'll just end by saying this, and then I'm looking forward to the discussion with Brian and Jessica and you as council members. We've been back here a couple of times now, and the entire time there have been good faith disagreements and good faith efforts on both sides to come up with agreements, and we're at a point where the mayor and the administration feel very strongly that the proposal we have put forth would represent that transformational way that the city composts and recycles, right? Currently, there are no apartment buildings that have composting requirements. This would mandate it for basically all of them. Currently, there are no restaurants that have composting requirements. This would do that for 85% of them. Events, similarly, it would be 9 in 10 people who attend events in Denver would attend an event that has composting and recycling. So this is a massive sea change and a transformational good for how this city deals with its waste. Again, I think it's completely good faith disagreements at this point on the last couple of points. But the other concern that we have expressed to you all and that we've talked about with Brian and his organization is when you were talking about something this large of an undertaking, it's really important that we make sure we do it right. And that I think a lot of people, myself included, would love to see everything composted, everything recycled perfectly. When you're talking about a city of over 700,000 people, that's just not practical. And what we're trying to do is propose a very, very ambitious plan, but one that we believe is workable and that doesn't negatively impact its citizens and its small businesses. So with that, I will stop talking.
Thanks, Tim. All right, before we get into the speaking queue, I wanted to take a moment of personal privilege before I go into these questions. So hearing the conversation today, it's clear that there is still substantial good faith disagreement between the two sides of this item. We're in an impasse here in committee, and while this item will likely go to be subject to ample debate on the floor for the entire council body, there is nothing further we can do with this item today. And there's no reason for us to keep this bill in committee any longer, and therefore I'm recommending that this item be passed out of committee and allow for full debate on the floor, which may include discussions regarding amendments before the whole body in the next 2 weeks. And so that's my recommendation. I'll turn it over to Council President Sandoval for questions and then Council Member Eldredge.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the sentiments. I feel the same. It needs to be moved out of committee and debated on the council floor, so I'll be in favor of moving it out of committee. Mine is trying to figure out how to frame it, if it's a question or a comment. My family's owned La Casita my entire life, and it's really hard to do business in this environment right now. And I've been asking a lot of my restaurants. I go out to eat a lot. I don't cook at home as much as I should. And I'll just say that I've given the administration the same feedback, and so I want the committee to hear it. Restaurants in Northwest Denver don't know about this ordinance. They just really don't. They're not aware of it. I've gone to Tacos Jalisco. I've gone to La Casita. I've gone to all my food places. I've gone to the feds. I mean, you name it. And this impacts them. And when I go and talk to the small local restaurants in my community and ask them, small coffee shops, anyone, I'm like, hey, are you aware of this ordinance? Have you been reached out to? Are you feeling representative? And to tell you the truth, no one knows about it. They're like, you're the first person who's mentioned it. I said it was passed by the voters of Denver. And everybody I've talked to in the restaurant industry, not the restaurant association, I want to be clear, my family's never participated at La Casita in the restaurant association. They don't pay those fees. They've never paid for being represented by the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. My dad said that he wasn't going to waste his money on paying membership fees when he could do it himself. And so most of these restaurants are not represented by the Restaurant Association or any other type of association. It's just they own a restaurant. They feel like these proposals could negatively impact them and that they're hanging on by a thread. And that any of these foreseen costs with all of the food costs that are going up, all of the equipment costs that are going up, all of the hauling costs that are going up, the fluctuation in prices of tomatoes, the fluctuation of prices in avocados, the fluctuation of prices of everything, that my small businesses just don't feel at this time that I can support the recommendations from the committee. I just don't think there's been advocacy done in my neighborhood. And I'll just say, these are just ones I've lived in the north side my entire life. Necio, like none of the
the restaurants that have bilingual speakers and our small minority businesses that have been established there for a very, very long time. They're just not aware of this. And so I'm going to be, and I'm not willing to debate that. It's just my lived experience. No one can tell me I'm wrong because I go and talk to these people all the time. So if you want to debate that, I'm not going to get into the debate right now. I just want to move this ordinance forward, and I want to figure out. I also have heard from people in Parks and Recreation that are really concerned about some of our small. When the prior administration established the Office of Special Events, we put requirements on defibrillators. We put requirements on all these small special events that you have to get cross permitting, and then you have to go get a sales license, and then you have to go to Dottie, and then you have to go this and that. And it's like 500 steps to put a movie on in the park on. Where prior, it just used to be like, okay, you want to put on a movie in the park? Let's go get a park application. Let's get this, this, and that. And so it feels like increasingly difficult to the point where city council, our central office, has to have a defibrillator that we can share out to community so that the community can do these small events. My office puts together a like a little form. You have to sign it out. My staff goes to central, gets the defibrillator, takes it to the event. Then they have to bring it back, and it has to be a whole waiver. And so I think there's this collision between the Office of Special Events, all of these other fees that are coming down. All the restaurants are having to pay sidewalk fees. They'll have to include that. So I think just at this time, I'm ready to see this ordinance move forward, and I will just take it upon myself to make sure that I'm educating the restaurants in my community, because I just do not feel like they have been represented. And I told the mayor's office the same thing. I don't feel like they've been represented on either side. And so it's my job as the council person and who's passing this legislation to take this on myself and do it. But I'm just gonna say, like, I don't know how many places I've gone where I've talked about this and I talked to the owner and they're just not aware of it because they're not part represented. So those are just my sentiments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Madam Chair, if I may, just to acknowledge real quickly, we hear you and we understand the concerns. I think that there's been a couple issues the city's acknowledged. One is that there's a bunch of departments, and whose job is it to market and educate? Even though this law has been on the books and enforceable since 2023, the outreach has been at different levels by different organizations. I want to acknowledge another thing that's bigger than us, and that is the state landfills. And the fact that we're in the process of looking at tipping fees for putting things in the landfill that could triple to quadruple the cost of putting trash without sorting it directly into the landfill. So we're trying to help move these processes in such a way that it reduces the impact on all. And I would just like to acknowledge that we have tried to, in our effort, what we put in forward in a red line version was our belief that that would be the amendment proposed, and that put in a buffer of 4 years additional timeline to allow restaurants to become prepared for this process.
Thank you. Council Member Alvidres, sorry, and then followed up with Councilman Flint.
Thank you, Committee Chair. And thank you both for all of your time on this. I was looking back, and it's very crazy to me that we're still having this conversation and this was passed by the voters in 2022. I think that people understood what they were voting on and widely passed it, and I am concerned about not representing the will of the voters. And I think that they do want to be able to go out to eat and not feel like they are contributing to climate change as significantly. I think we have to balance wanting to support our restaurants and keep them alive, and also it's easier for a small restaurant to figure out what to do with the smaller amount of waste that they have. So how can we find that path forward. I also think community events are really important. But if we're not composting at a community event, I mean, it's honestly embarrassing because I travel and when I go other places, everywhere composts. There's composts and trash bins and there's recycling and we're far behind and parks is far behind. I get so many complaints that city parks don't offer composting and recycling. And so I feel like we have tried to lead and our voters are trying to have us lead and we are falling behind and that is concerning to me. I think that when we talk about our budget letter and we're saying climate change is an emergency, we have to also look at that when we're looking at this policy. And so I am very concerned about the walking back. I think that the administration can enforce what they do and don't want to. And it's not like we have enough city employees to go to every restaurant and make sure that they're doing this every day, even if we wanted to. And so I just want to express that I am concerned that we're back here, that nothing has really changed. And I want to say thank you for all your research and persistence on this, because I think it really matters. And it's very concerning to me that the landfill issue. It's terrifying, and I'm a mom, and I think about the world my son's going to have to inherit, and it's going to be inconvenient, and it's going to be expensive, and businesses could close. And we can't stop progress because we might lose some businesses. I think it's inconvenient to have to figure it out. I was concerned, I do have one question, which is about the food banks. Food banks are very important in District 7 for food access. Have you talked to the food banks? And the other thing I wonder is it as simple as they need to take the bread out of the bag and then they can compost it and get rid of the bag? So curious if you could speak to that issue.
Thank you, Councilwoman. That is a great question. I actually have worked with a wide variety of the food banks in the city and county of Denver over the last decade and have been engaging in these conversations. Outside of meat waste, there are a variety. We think about Southwest Ministries over in District 7, and their food goes directly to a farmer, other than the meat, for the animals to eat. So there's a process of volunteers taking the bread out that doesn't get given away, or depackaging food from plastic so that when it goes to the farm. At Denver Inner City Parish, they are part of the direct donation to the mutual aid communities, where the food that doesn't get consumed by their recipients actually goes to feed the homeless and the communities. And the waste product from that goes to a goat farm in Lakewood for the animals to eat it. And so in our red line amendment request, we have included alternative solutions that don't cost a dime to implement, so that the financial burden is not there, but that the interested organizations, farmers pick up yeast from our breweries and all the hops that are spent on a weekly basis. There is a giant infrastructure of capturing consumable food to provide it to people who don't have their own kitchens and to capture the waste to divert it from paid systems so that it has a beneficial use. And these organizations have neighboring partners that they will be able to implement. Metro Caring has the senior center just down the street where their leftover foods can go to feed the people that come into the facility on a daily basis. Know that we have also worked with the state legislature to an HB 25-1166 that now allows churches and individuals. The food truck can donate to the homeless people right on the side of the street, and they can mark those donations in their accounting to reduce costs and capture the tax advantages where applicable.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that was another thing I was thinking of. If we're pressuring them maybe to have less food waste, maybe they will be more responsible with the food that they purchase and be more responsible with making sure that their food goes to someone that can still eat it instead of throwing it away. So that's just a thought. But thank you for all of your outreach. And this is definitely a tough issue. I appreciate that. Thank you, Committee Chair.
Thank you so much. Councilman Flynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian, you have a red line here. And in the presentation, there's a blue line and there's also a black line. So, and then Tim, you sent out on Monday night a rather lengthy document that's very heavy, and so I confess I did not have time to read it before this committee meeting. So I'm trying to understand. minimizing exemptions to the plan, whose proposal is it that the small restaurants be exempt for 2 years and 2 years? Is that
so? That recommendation is a modification of the city's recommendation. The city recommends a $2 million annual threshold before diversion implements.
Right.
And that requirement never establishes a baseline where new businesses, as part of their operating plan, build in diversion as part of the operating costs. Mm-hmm. So what we have done in acknowledging the concerns is to build in 4 years of additional exemptions in diversion to allow for small businesses to assess and take the time to find where they're going to be able to make this work before being required by 2030 that all new businesses have to write it in their plan so that when they open, the diversion is part of their plan.
And this is retail food establishment.
This is retail food.
Not all businesses.
Retail food.
Just retail food.
Yes, sir.
Just to be clear. Okay. So Green Latinos also did the blue line.
Can you reference what slide, or is it a document page?
It is slides. It's the minimizing exemptions section, which is three slides.
Yep. I see. Oh, so blue. So red line is removing.
You're removing.
The city. Blue would be our modified verbiage.
Got it. Okay. So I think you said, Brian, you said earlier that the compost haulers were saying that 60 gallons or less than 60 gallons, was not, you know, that's not worthwhile picking up.
Essentially.
So why would we not have a permanent exemption? If it doesn't make sense now, why would it make sense in 2030?
That's a great question. So the idea in this was to build room for the infrastructure to grow. The Waste No More regulations specifically outline a pathway of shared use. Chris Chiari, task force member, owner of the Patterson Inn, is a great example because he worked with three apartment buildings adjacent to him to come up with a shared use plan for their recycling services. And so by allowing one business, one restaurant, might only have 60 or 50 gallons. But if there's four restaurants on the block, let's look at the Gaylord, up in Wash Park, the whole little block, the neighborhood of businesses stuck in the middle of it. There's four or five restaurants right next to each other. Mm-hmm. Each one of them might have 50 gallons, but combined, they'd have 200 gallons a week. And so because the regulations allow for shared or co-opted billable services, that would eliminate the one business from having a financial hardship of having to pay for the full service by themselves by working with neighbors to come up with and create creative solutions that have meaningful diversion implementation. Based on our exemption, our red lines, we feel that every five businesses that are no longer exempted, the calculations show that that's roughly 1 ton of methane emitted on an annual basis being reduced because it's not being created in a landfill.
You're not presuming that there will be a critical mass of small retail food establishments within a serviceable area that can be serviced by a compost hauler. I mean, I have restaurants in Southwest Denver that are here, there. They're not all together like maybe up on the north side or on Gaylord Street.
Sure, I hear you, and I want to address something that has never been discussed, and that is the retail versus or commercial versus residential hauling. And so Green Latinos is working on, with many partners, including CDPHD and the governor's office, examining how we can change the statutory regulations to allow for that one small business that's alley is part of an existing service by the city to be able to opt in to organic diversion where the route already exists. Currently, I'll use the Whittier Cafe because it sits at the top of my head right now. They are not allowed legally to contract as an opt-in with the city for organic right. diversion. They would be required to have alternate private hauling or to haul it themselves, right? And that is a statewide issue that we're addressing where all communities in the state are struggling with developing more organic material diversion in the business industry because of the limitations of state statute. So we are simultaneously working on finding solutions to that, but we cannot stop one process to wait for another one to move forward.
Right. Curious why you would strike out exemptions for food waste producers, not including mobile retail food establishments, push carts, food peddlers, or temporary retail food establishments. I'm thinking again of Marcella out on the corner. You're removing the exemption for the hot dog cart. Is that?
No, I think there may have been some mistake in our first time in working on a city legislative piece. I would suggest that push carts, food peddlers are definitely de minimis, and the exemption shows that they're de minimis. So automatically, they would be exempted. The issue here is that the food bank receives donations down the line from the restaurants. You know, when we were at the corner bakery out there for several years in our protests, they came to a point where they're like, hey, we're going to help by donating this to the homeless, right? That's a valid process. But the places that receive the donations, they're like the end of the line, and then they would just landfill it according to the way the legislation sits currently by the city's recommendations. So by closing those gaps to say that the end of the line recipients then still have a responsibility to move that food out of the landfill, we're closing the loop. We're making sure that all diversion keeps the diversion out of the landfill. Noting that even hospitals were exempt in its entirety from the legislation here. And virtually every hospital has a kitchen. So no back of the house waste would ever get diverted there either. And so it may be that as we try to work with the city in the final amendment version so that we have a consensus by everybody, that we might have to reintroduce how push carts or food peddlers maybe continued with an exemption, but definitely the majority of those have some back of the house methodology where we're looking at the combined methane emissions. And again, by changing this exemption, we believe that for every five businesses that are no longer exempt, we're looking at at 1 ton of methane emissions diverted.
Mm-hmm. All right, last
annually.
One. What is a temporary retail food establishment? I know that's city? Probably a technical term, but what would I see when I went to a temporary retail food establishment?
Good afternoon, I'm Eric Rogers, Policy Director, Excise and Licenses. So the language of each of those particular items aligns with a specific type of retail food license. So it covers many different things. Temporary food establishment would be like a pop-up restaurant at an event.
Okay.
Versus right, a push cart, mobile retail food mobile. So I know we have forthcoming feedback, but I would say, right, to the extent we can retain terms that align with existing license
sure.
types.
I just wanted to visualize
yes.
what it's been. So.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's all.
Quickly.
I pulled up the definition if you want me to read it verbatim.
I'm good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Council, are you complete there?
Yes.
Okay. Councilmember Gilmore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So can you send me a list of who the current haulers are for 80239 and 80249, Mont Bello and Green Valley Ranch? after this meeting?
Sure, I can tell you right now that they're primarily Wampost and Compost Colorado. There's also a rogue organization that goes direct to farm and doesn't go to a compost operation. But those are the two primary that exist currently.
And so where are they located at?
Compost Colorado is at the National Western on off I-70, and Wampost is roughly along the Aurora-Denver border.
Okay. Because right now, I'm really concerned if we don't have affordable haulers that we can refer to small, especially people of color owned, women owned restaurants, they're going to have a hardship in participating. And so I guess it seems, I know we want perfect with this, but if it's been 2.5 years, I'm just trying to calculate what the carbon footprint has been since then, and is there a benefit to getting this adopted and then building up the composting, the haulers, because if somebody gets somebody from Aurora, Denver, great, but if an operator is having to come from National Western every day and drive on I-70 all the way out to 56th and Piccadilly Road for Green Valley Ranch, I don't know if at the end of the day when we're calculating all of this, if we're saving or not, and that's really hard to do outreach with a small business owner to tell them the city's not just trying to bureaucratically regulate them, and we're really trying to work together to minimize the effects of climate change.
Yeah, I'm excited to answer that question. And first, because Wampost is a BIPOC women-owned business who specifically offer small business discounts to get their small businesses up and running.
But do they have capacity to serve 5,000 to 6,000 small businesses?
I would tell you that the capacity to serve in Scraps is the other operator, and we do not want to forget them because they do serve across the city and county of Denver. And I would say that since Waste No More was drafted, the capacity has risen over 400% for hauling and diversion capacities. And this diversion capacity does not just exist with commercial haulers, but with local organizations who are doing local source diversion. Denver Urban Gardens has over 15 gardens across the city where diversion occurs and people can bring materials to create in their compost on site. There's other such projects. The state has changed the regulations to allow for more localized compost, and the state and national compost councils both recognize the necessity for as local as possible diversion. We don't want to be hauling Front Range diversion to the Four Corners region, as an example, right? It's not logical. So in the same way, we don't want to be hauling from Southwest Denver to Northeast Denver vehicles to be doing pickup. We're promoting the industries themselves are building for localized hauling and even considering multiple sites, just like businesses have multiple sites. You go to 6 different McDonald's locations, in X amount of distance, that these organizations are looking at how they can build localized for localized collection and creation of diversion.
So it'd be great if you can send me those over. I'm hearing from small businesses in Montbello and Green Valley Ranch that they haven't had any outreach and that it's going to be a hardship for them. And those are residents who might own homes in the city as well. And we want them to stay. We want them to have businesses. And so I'm really concerned about the capacity issues on it. And so thanks for the information. I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So there are no other folks in the queue. Did you all want to wrap up with anything?
I think we don't want to go line for line for the suggestions, but I do want to clarify just a couple of the points. One is that donations as a viable way to manage your food waste is already in the ordinance, clearly as an option. And so is shared service collection. So I just want to flag that those were already written into the ordinance. And then there was a lot related to education requirements, and those are also in the ordinance, just kind of written in a different way that's more universally applicable and refers back to the rulemaking process. So I'm sure we can address most of the recommendations, and but I just wanted to flag particularly the food donation piece is already built in, as is the shared.
Great.
And then just one last point to a concern that Councilwoman Gilmore raised that I think has been talked about a lot. Based on some conversations we had with Green Latinos and some other folks, we have in the latest draft of the ordinance included a reporting requirement on each of the sections. The first report is 3 years after implementation, and then every 3 to 5 years after that, which to exactly the point that's been discussed around capacity and costs and everything else would mandate that the executive directors of the relevant agencies would look at all of the data, look at the market, look at how the program is being implemented, and then state, based on all of that information, I believe that the exemption should remain in effect, or to exactly what we've been discussing, at this point, the capacity of the waste haulers is such that it's not going to be the financial hardship on the smaller businesses because there's enough of them in the marketplace. And so that they could recommend through rules and regulations to reduce or eliminate some of these exemptions. So just wanted to flag that as well. And I'll just end kind of where I started by thanking the council members. Thank you to Councilwoman Lewis for your patience as we've come back a couple of times. And then also just to frame, I think this discussion has been indicative of, at this point, we are about 90-95% alignment on what, again, will be a transformational way in which we compost and recycle in the city. What we're talking about is some of those kind of on the margins exemptions, not to say that they don't matter. They matter a lot to the advocates. They also matter a lot to the small businesses that are going to be impacted by this. But I can tell you from the administration's perspective and from the mayor's perspective, we're excited to get this rolled out, to start having the impact that the voters indicated they wanted to have in 2022. So thank you all for your time. Thank you all for all the efforts.
Great. Go ahead quickly.
The last thought, we definitely want to thank and appreciate everybody for their hard work, including the city and the various agencies. In the addressing of the issue and concern of capacity, I want to say that our haulers themselves have expressed frustration because the website up until this year, the end of last year, indicated a lack of enforcement. So while they were out trying to build capacity by growing the businesses, businesses were going to the Waste No More website and seeing that it was not a requirement that was actually expected of them. And so that was one of the things that has had a negative impact on the effective expansion of capacity. But that all the businesses that do haul and new ones are coming, you know, the capacity is there currently. The capacity was believed to be there when the measure was written.
Thank you. Thank you both for being here. Thank you all so much. We will need a motion and a second to move this out of committee.
So, first motion. I move to move it out of committee.
I get a first from Council President Sandoval. Second. Councilman Finn. Do we need a roll call vote?
I'm drunk.
No. Great. Thank you all so much. I will say before we wrap up this, I'd like to mention that today's committee meeting is actually the last one for Biz Committee as it currently exists, and it has been my honor to chair for just over a year. So thank you for the opportunity. I've had such a great time. So you will waste no more of my time.
Prior to the vote, DRC said you wanted to second. I like it.